When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia. Movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.
This is Troy McGinnis, and you're listening to the Agile Uprising Podcast.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the Agile Uprising Podcast. I'm Paul Elia, and I'm joined today by special guest Troy McGinnis, president of Focused Objective. Hey, Troy.
Hi, Paul.
Troy, I wanted to start with, I love you've got this pin on your Twitter feed that says, forecasting is about answering the right questions to a transparent degree of certainty with as little effort as possible. I mean, that I just love that. But you've actually put quite a bit of your time and energy into making this possible for other people. You offer a lot of information and tools over at Focused Objective. Tell us why this is a passion of yours. Why do you have this pinned to your Twitter feed?
Great question. Yeah, it took a while to get to this. Basically, it was out of frustration, like most things in life are. Most good inventions are out of frustration. You know, I was always looking for ways of getting an answer and dealing with uncertainty faster. And I kept coming up against sort of objections. Oh, it's not perfect. Well, no, either is what you're doing now, to be honest. Or and I needed a way to try and get people to understand that, you know, you can't eliminate the uncertainty. You've got to learn to work with it. So I came out with some tools to try and help people, you know, make better decisions in the face of that uncertainty, and spend about the last 5 years doing that.
So, and a key piece of your software is Monte Carlo simulation. It's typically something we see in like the mathematical or physical sciences. What led you to go down the road of doing that for software estimation?
It is used a lot it's used to answer questions where you don't have the ability to answer it purely mathematically. Or if you do have an ability to answer it pure mathematically, it would take too long to do. Monte Carlo forecasting really is just the addition operator of uncertainty, of ranges. If you want to add together a piece of work is going to take between 1 and 5 days, and the second piece of work is going to take between 2 and 10 days, and the third piece of work is going to take between 3 and 4 days, if you want to do the math on those, then Monte Carlo forecasting and simulation is the tool that you use. And that's pretty much what we're doing when we have a set of work that we want to get done and we want to combine all the unknowns and uncertainty about how long that work might take. So it really is a complex name for the addition operator of ranges.
Right, right. So it's kind of like you've got a simulator tool on your website that's the traffic light simulator. And it's kind of like the best case scenario of making all the traffic lights and the worst case scenario of getting stopped at every red light.
That's right. And Monte Carlo forecasting works out how many are in the range in between those ranges and where the most likely might occur.
Right. So what kind of models do we put together then in the software world, and what kind of questions can we answer with those models?
It's an interesting question. I mean, I guess my most recent way of explaining this is look at Google Maps when you try and get navigation directions. The question that they first and foremost answer is how long it's going to take to get between two points. They don't start out answering the question, what time will we arrive? Because you don't know when you're going to leave. So it gives you can do a navigation forecast about how long it's going to take to get between where you live and where you're going out to dinner, and it will just tell you how long in minutes. But the moment that you hit navigate, now it can calculate from now how long it's going to be. So I think the question we should be answering more is how long things will take and less of when will things be done. And so that's what I've been trying to get the tools to head down to answer that question. So first question I want to answer is how long it's going to take. And that's often enough to make a comparison between three or four different set of features to work out which one you're going to do to hit a certain delivery date. But you still got to make sure that the assumption that you're actually going to leave in your car or you actually have the team in place to do a software project is true.
I like that. And it's real world too in the software scenario. You go for funding for a particular project and they want to know how long it's going to take, how much effort is going to go into it. And then they, for whatever reason, it may take a while before you actually get that funding. And then they come back and go, okay, name that tune. Actually, the first thing you should do probably is reforecast immediately and say, well, those conditions were true when I asked for the money, but things have changed.
Yeah. So when you do the original forecast, you got to spell out the conditions that make it invalid. And the first one you should have is, if you don't give me a yes answer in the next month, all bets are off.
That's right.
One thing I find, everyone, even if they don't say it, has a date in their head already. And I think what we need to try and do is get that date out of people and tell them what they can get by that date. So don't go answering the question about even how long it's going to take. Start giving them the ability of asking when they need something and then saying, and this is the conditions that we would have to have to make that possible. It's a far more productive discussion because now you're looking at all the assumptions that have to come true for that forecast to come true. And, you know that you're already failing the moment the first assumption isn't true anymore. And normally the first assumption is you didn't tell us to start in time and now the team's gone off and done something else.
Invariably, when you're asked to put a plan together and to go pitch for funding, if the dollar amount or the time aren't even close to what your sponsors had in mind when they asked you to look into it, they're just not even going to entertain you. It's so far off the mark. It'd be great to be able to have an open dialogue from the beginning like that. What would be within the realm of reason for you in terms of a dollar figure or a date? And then I could go back and run this model and tell you the assumptions and conditions. But it feels like there's almost a lack of trust. Like instead of us being partners together, it's that vendor relationship. Like if I told the tree company, I want to take a tree down at my house and here's how much money I have, they'll take every drop of it, right? Or
yeah.
Or if I tell you the latest date that I could stomach, then you'll take up until that date. So there always seems to be this element of mistrust in why we're asked to blindly go off and calculate something before we even start the dialogue. It's kind of reasonable for you to ask me to make the first bid, but I don't want to go off and do it very detailed at first. So let me run some numbers and come back to you and say, how about this? And then that actually starts the conversation.
And that's exactly the right thing to do. There's sort of a lack of partnership, I find. I think if you could fix one problem in forecasting and estimation, it's about spending some time outside of work getting to know the people who are asking the questions. Because often they don't mean to. It's just misaligned incentives.
The Gantt chart technique that many of us were taught early on and we used it and we did the little Gantt charts, that's what our sponsors and our CIOs and our CTOs that are currently in management today, they also came up with that. And that's what they expect to see a lot of times. So how do you gain their confidence that this kind of a technique is as trustworthy as those Gantt charts that they grew up with?
Yeah, it's a couple of points on this one, I guess. One of the reasons I went from having a more complex set of software for doing forecasts to a simple spreadsheet is that the spreadsheet allows you to get it set up and then sit beside that stakeholder and have the discussion about this is the uncertainty I'm dealing with. Can you understand where I'm coming from? So the forecasting tools and the spreadsheets are about having that conversation. Now, the reason the Gantt charts and all the upfront analysis seems appealing is it makes people feel that they've got the uncertainty under control. And, you know, we know that it's not under control. We know that there's still so much more to be learned when we start digging into doing the detail. But imagine if you're going out making promises to customers that they're going to get a certain feature or an update, or the customer is threatened to leave if they don't get a fix for a certain specific problem for them by a certain date. Imagine if you're being told that I can't give you a certainty that you're going to hit that exact date. So they respond by saying, please do more analysis. So I think until you actually hit and show them that you understand the bind they're in and you have to work together to achieve it, you're not going to solve that problem. But The main thing is that if we're in a risky sort of world and we are dealing with this uncertainty, so the Gantt chart, don't stop doing it. Do another forecasting method that gets you a similar result and then drop the one that's more effort once you've proven that your new way works. So nothing, I would never recommend anyone stop doing what they're currently doing in forecasting until they've built up trust that they've got an easier way of doing it.
That's perfect. Yeah, you just answered the question perfectly. And that is, don't try to come in with this as the one and only answer and sell it. Come in with the way that you've been asked to do it for a while that you know your sponsors are comfortable with and say, oh, by the way, I have this other technique. It's actually way less effort to come up with the same answer. I did it in parallel with the way that we've been doing these estimations, but I wanted to share it with you and kind of go over it with you. And it's just an opportunity for us in the future. We could possibly use this technique to come up with what ifs faster.
And you can go back 3 months from now and prove that you could have forecast where you are today. So often just going back 3, 6, 9 months and proving that you could have forecast where you are today is the first step that you should do no matter what forecasting method you're using. Because if you can't forecast something that recently happened, then you have no right to forecast something that you think may happen in the future.
Sure.
So that often builds up enough your trust that your model is actually working at all in your environment. So you, even no matter what method you use, even if your existing method, you should be able to go back 3 months and prove that it accurately predicted today.
Right. And we were talking before the show about how we have all this historical data. If you're in especially a larger environment, you're probably using a tool. I have no favorite here in the mix, but some agile software management tool that allows you to have backlog and to do sprints if you're doing Scrum, or continuous if you're doing Kanban, and keep up with the stories that are in flight and the stories as they're getting split. And then as they're getting closed, you have all this historical data that you could feed into a model like this. And I asked you about, you know, your thoughts on integrating your spreadsheet directly with that repository of data. And you cautioned me and said, hey, no, you know, I tried that before. And so I want to see if you could share with our listeners why maybe you tried it before, but you learned that it's not exactly the way to go.
Yeah, sure. It does. There are a couple of concerns I have when you start grabbing data automatically out of a tool that's collecting the data. Now, first point is that a lot of the data gets stale very quickly. Think about if you were measuring a team throughput. Well, if that team changed size or split or went, or some of the senior people went to build other new teams, it doesn't really matter what your throughput samples were 6 weeks ago. It's not going to be that in the future. So I find a lot of the tools which grab data for you don't give you a chance to cast your eye over that data and say whether it's still valid or not. And that could give you a very misleading forecast. And the second thing is so that's on if you're measuring the pace that you think a team's going to deliver and you're grabbing that data automatically, you should err on the side of needing to say that, yes, the team I plan to use can achieve the pace that the team was achieving and only include samples which are valid. Now, on the size of the backlog and the pace that you appear to be running, the big problem I see mostly is if the throughput that you've calculated often includes defects and cards and stories that were split when they were being worked on by the team. The way we talk about stories and analysis and when we're discussing whether we should do something is often larger than the size of the stories that make sense to implement as a developer. So often that's a 2-to-3-to-1 ratio. You know, one story that we have in planned in the backlog often becomes split into two stories plus one defect to fix. Huh. Now, if you're recording the throughput of just what was completed by the team, you would appear to be doing three stories, a pace of three stories at a time, but really you've only delivered one originally planned backlog story. So you appear to be moving three times faster than you are. So if you're using the throughput values that are coming out of your tool, and then you're using the number of stories remaining in your backlog, and they haven't been split, and they haven't had a chance to have a defect reported against them yet, your forecast is going to say you're going to deliver three times faster than you actually will. So that's a pretty significant error.
Right.
So I just use caution. You know, the throughput that we often measure is in kilometers per hour, and our backlog is actually in miles per hour. You know, it's a smaller number, but we appear to be moving faster.
Right.
Just a unit conversion issue, and it's just a splitting. So I find in most of my all of my spreadsheets give you the ability to say what range will story split somewhere between 1 to 3 times. And if you need a default, if you don't know what it is, it's normally between 1 and 3 times is a safe default to assume.
Right. That plus your defect rate, right? And you can iterate on those numbers as well, right? Yep, in your simulations, absolutely. Right? So let's assume that we are 1-to-1, but no, let's say that one story becomes 4 stories, and then on the defect side, you do the same thing. And it's, again, you're catching all the green traffic lights or catching all the red traffic lights in your simulation.
That's right. And then the third one, and this is often the largest, is only by doing the work sometimes there's something we can't know until we get a certain amount of work completed. So we build the feature, and then we can test to sort of prove that it's going to be scalable and it's going to not have memory or performance issues, or it's going to run on a certain browser. My day it was IE6, and now it's probably Safari. Those things, those risks, they're scope that we may have to do, but we don't know yet. And often this manifests itself near the end of projects. You know, we get to near the end, and then there's this long tail of almost done. And your forecast needs to include these. It needs to consider that we need to highlight the fact that knowing what we know now, this is the work we know we have to do, but there's a larger set of work, often larger than the original backlog size, that we may have to do to get the final thing shipped. And of course, you can minimize that if you work in smaller size stories and smaller features, but you can never eliminate it. And that stuff isn't often built into the tools which are doing Monte Carlo forecasting. It's an uncomfortable discussion you have to have with your team, honestly, sort of saying, if we build this, what could go wrong? And let's make sure that we have a way of determining that early rather than later in this sort of feature delivery cycle. So they're the three cautions. They're the three biggest errors I see. I see that the work splits. I see the fact that there are risks that we don't cover properly. And I see that we use historical data about the pace that we're going to deliver that's no longer valid.
Right. What do you think about the no estimates movement? I think it's intentionally inflammatory because I don't think anybody really means no estimates, but they mean something different. What do you think?
Well, I'm not exactly sure what they mean. So to me, if we're just estimating the work and then we're sort of assuming that it's going to be delivered at a certain pace, we run into a, we could be not modeling the uncertainty as it's really known. So I absolutely think that you need to come, I think to stay in business, it is a legitimate business question to try and understand what can we get by a certain date.
Right.
And I think it's up to us to somehow find a way to answer that question with a minimal amount of effort again, right? I mean, mm-hmm. I think current estimation assumes that we've covered all uncertainty where we haven't. And I think we try and eliminate that uncertainty by spending far too long discussing things that are completely unknowable. So I do believe that there are better ways and faster ways to get to a equal or better answer without spending months or weeks estimating and forecasting. I think that, so from that sense, I'm with the no estimates crowd. But if it's at the point that we should just, that it's unknowable, I can't agree with that.
Right.
I think we can reduce the uncertainty. We can incorporate the uncertainty into our forecast so that we're right more often than we're wrong. I think at the moment we're wrong more often than we're right. Mm-hmm. And I'm trying to narrow that gap.
Hey, another key position that I've heard in your talks, and it's really important, is measure the work, not the worker. And you talked one time about in aggregate, we can see some things together, but don't ever call one person out in the visualizations that you present. Can you say more about that?
Sure. The other side of actually getting good data to forecast with is making sure that that data isn't tainted. And the quickest way to taint data is to make it embarrassing for people to report data honestly. And if you're starting to put up on a big dashboard screen in the lunchroom number of defects with a developer's name against it, don't be surprised that people start not logging defects against their friends. They put them on post-it notes on their monitor. Now you have two problems. You think you've got a lower defect count than you actually have, and you really don't know how many defects you have that are going to need to be sort of resolved that may stop you shipping. So by making embarrassing people, you're just causing the data to go underground. And whenever I say this, people are saying, oh, you're just being all soft, touchy, coachy, feely sort of person. Often I'm not, because people who know me know that that's not me. I'm worried about the validity of the data we're capturing, and I'm worried that we no longer have a clear picture of what's actually occurring in the project. So not only is it bad against the people, I think it's a bad business concept to, it's leaving you with no data to make a better business decision. Right. So there is a real legitimate business reason for being really careful that you never put someone in an embarrassing situation with data that you're capturing or showing.
Yeah. The physics notion of the observer effect says that if you observe a situation, it'll necessarily change that situation. This is kind of a corollary of that, or it's very much related to that.
Absolutely.
The other thing that goes with this that you've stressed, you have your dashboards. You never really show one trend line by itself. You've got quadrants, right? Measuring things side by side. And I've got a lot of ideas why I love that, but I want you to share what sort of metrics have worked really well side by side, and why do you do that?
Yeah, okay. It comes from some, I guess it's the balanced scorecard sort of concept. I think Larry Maccheroni took it to a much larger degree when he was working at Rally. At the time, he had the software development performance index or so forth. But to break it down simply, if you're going to measure something, you're going to cause an impact to the system. And if it's the only thing you measure, people will achieve it at all costs. Your job is to show and help people see and understand that they're making a trade. when they choose to be better at one metric, they're perhaps damaging another metric. So you need to help people. Your job as a coach is to help them make smart trades between these opposing forces. So say we did measure throughput and we sort of said all that matters is that your team throughput number looks higher. Well, let's assume that they don't just sort of start splitting the story smaller so their throughput number goes up. That'll probably happen. If there's a limit to how far they can go on that, and then they start trying to increase the throughput number by working weekends and hours and not talking and then trying to open up as many, start as many items as possible so they've got some chance of finishing something. Well, now you're going to have an impact on cycle time. We know as work in progress goes up, they're not really working on three things at once. They're only working on one of them. So the other two are accumulating cycle time but making no progress. So you're going to see cycle time averages go up across the board. And heaven forbid now that they're tired, only coffee can only go so far. So now you start getting a higher defect count. So, you know, it seemed like a great idea to say, you know, we can make this release if we just get our throughput higher. But if you start charting just throughput alone, you may miss the fact that your defect count's going through the roof and you're not going to ship anyway.
Right.
And that's what you're trying to do. So I try and get teams to, for every measure, you know, we're going to measure throughput as a measure of delivery pace, and we're also going to measure open Sev1 defect counts just in case we push too hard on throughput. And I make them do that for every measure. And I try and portray that on the dashboard by never showing one of the measures alone. I always show the compensating measures. So if a trend does change and it looks like they're nailing it and their throughput is going through the roof, someone can have the harder conversation of saying, yeah, but look at the price we're paying. I'm happier to slow down to burn some defects in the next sprint. So the dashboards are about having that adult conversation about you don't get much for free and we're going to push in this area, but we're going to also keep an eye on these other areas to see if we cause damage. We're only willing to pay a certain price.
So you started, well, at least your book that I read was like a 2011 book. And I imagine you were practicing this technique before you decided to share it like that. That was midway. Agile Manifesto was 2001, midway. And again, I was doing technically something called Spiral Model in 93. And that really had a lot of similarity to Agile. So it's not like Agile was born in 2001, but it got that name and really started to take off. The way we work in software has changed a lot. How has this changed the modeling setups that you do? Right? Like, so if you work with a team that's doing your classic waterfall where you got developers and you got testers and they don't sit anywhere near each other and they may even be on other sides of the planet, that's one model. And then if you have test shifted left, security shifted left, a little more, cross-functional team working together, that's a different model, right?
Sure. Yeah. I think the biggest improvement I'm seeing on the Agile world, if I contrast it to the models for waterfall, is the batch size is smaller. We try and get to a shippable product more frequently. And that's really important. And there's, you know, I'm not selling Agile, but if I wanted to sell it, its biggest benefit is the fact that we eliminate growing uncertainty more regularly. So by getting to a deliverable point more often, what happens is we actually eliminate a large amount of growing uncertainty. Now, in the waterfall world, what would hit us is the fact that we wouldn't find out until 1 year in that the solution we had wasn't going to work. Uncertainty and risk grew throughout that whole period of time. So with the Agile and the Spiral sort of models and all those sort of models, what we really did was start saying it's unacceptable to grow risk at that linear rate.
Right.
In cases, we want to bring that back to near zero at more regular intervals. More frequently you ship, the less risk that you accumulate. So whereas the early models in you know, trying to model things out over a year, stuff done later, you would assume would be impacted more by growing uncertainty. Now, in an agile forecast, we just assume that the uncertainty is local to the work that we're doing and not accumulating. If I look at a delivery cycle and a company is delivering once every 6 months, you know, I know that there's going to be a large number of risks that they're going to encounter later in the last 3 months of that delivery process. So I include incorporated in the model. But if they're delivering once a week, I make no adjustments whatsoever. So if you can get down to a more continuous sort of delivery of smaller items, you're actually solving that. Remember I said that big hitter at the end that causes most projects to be delayed in shipping is that accumulation of risks and the risks that we don't model. That's what you're really solving by shipping more often and doing smaller batches. You're eliminating those risks from growing.
Isn't it also true that we have less handoffs per se, depending on the technique that you're using? Again, and I'm digging into personal experiences of the test team might be testing multiple products, not just the one that me as a developer was working on. And so my thing to test might sit in the loading dock waiting for a while. And then also to go out the door into production, it might sit for a while after the testers have done it. And yet there are still problems to be discovered on the way to production that we haven't discovered yet. And so you're being called back into action to change some code when your brain has already moved on to yet another problem space, another project. So do you model is it baked into something else? Do you model the handoffs? Is that rework? Is that defect count? How is that showing up in the model?
So there are sort of two ways of modeling. Well, one is you can model the cycle times of the different steps that work goes through. And then the other way of modeling is let's just treat that delivery as a black box and let's just use the throughput delivery rate and assume that, and we don't really care how it got to that point. There's a lot of questions in the models and forecasts that you can only answer if you do look at cycle time, the steps that work goes through and the dependencies on work being started once it hits a certain point. It's a massive impact. You know, if we are splitting test out as a separate step and they're not a team which is dedicated to sort of one project, then work is going to sit idle waiting for them to be finished with what they're currently doing to pick up that work. And then when they find a defect and it goes back to the developer, who again will let that work wait until they finish what they're doing to pick it up again to fix it. And now they've got to recollect what the hell they did to get it going in the first place before they even fix the defect. That will have a huge impact in the forecast, and that's where you scale and you go across multiple teams, you're going to encounter the same problems. That sort of coordination and management. Yes, if you can collapse teams down and remove dependencies, and if you can have a team which has every skill set that it needs to do the delivery, you will deliver faster, more reliably, and with lower defects. And I try and help people understand that risk. There's a set of spreadsheets I have which do surveys. You list out all the skills that are required to do a delivery, and then you find out what you have available locally in your team versus you need to wait for someone else for. And if I see a lot of you need other teams or other people who aren't dedicated to your team, then, yeah, I adjust the forecast to account for that. And it's normally quite a huge impact.
And how do you adjust the forecast? So I know, like, you have the basically the continuous or the iterative approaches, Kanban versus Scrum, and for our agile listeners. And so it sounds like you would want to model that dynamic differently depending on whether you went continuous or iterative.
Yeah, or whether they're dedicated or not dedicated to the team. Like all things, you do two forecasts. You do a forecast with the world with a dedicated team and a forecast with the team being a shared service. And then you work out whether it's economically better to solve the problem by actually getting those skills on your team, or whether it's economically better to just leave it as is and deal with the delays. So it's an unemotional decision.
Yeah, great. You just set it up. I mean, that's what I was driving for is like, and I'm kind of like you, I'm not the big heart kind of agilist. And it might sound like I am. I have people who accuse me of being that. And then there are other people who know I can be a real jerk. It's about the fact that it makes good business sense that I like this. And so you want to be able to say objectively whether allowing the silos to continue to operate the way they're operating and have these handoffs and have this certain dynamic makes more sense in this situation versus more cross-functional, right? And sometimes it does make sense to have some handoffs, and sometimes it doesn't. And you want to be objective about it.
Yes. And the problem exists in every factory and manufacturing plant around the world, right? I mean, it's, you know, you would like one person to pick up an item and touch it to completion, but that's uneconomically viable. Sometimes there's certain machinery that only makes sense to have one of. And if it happens infrequently, then you don't really need it on every team.
So your software, your technique, you make it available. People can come get it and run these things on their own. But you have customers that come to you that ask for your guidance in setting up these models. But I imagine you also have empowered and set up companies to run their own modeling shop, where it's not a, you know, one and done, we've done some models for you and kind of given you a hint. That maybe they actually provide this as a service to the enterprise, people who understand how to do this modeling. Is that a correct guess?
Yeah. I mean, I thought I've been doing this roughly for about 10 years now, that I'd start getting similar questions. And that turned out not to be true. I still get, what happens is I still get calls of sort of saying, you know, what is the impact of us not having, you're having remote teams. And there's always some subtlety to their question, which requires me to sit back and think of, oh, well, what, how would I model that? You know, I don't say that to the client.
Right.
I just look
at the concept. Sure.
Go back to the hotel room and, you know, order Chinese takeaway and a bottle of scotch and work through the night to try and work out, well, how could I help people understand the impact of these certain things? So I tend to do a lot of that. Most companies, the stuff isn't that complex to get started. You know, I do a 2-day training course and help them out with a couple of models. And then mostly I get a 1-hour phone call once a month saying, you know, can you check this to make sure it makes sense? So most people get self-sufficient very quickly. And I think, you know, you were recounting the story from Agile 2017. And a lot of people that get self-sufficient that I never even know about.
Yeah. So let me tell that story, because I've told it to you in person and I ran it by you to see if it was cool to talk about it on the show. But so 2017, Agile 2017, I went to two talks of yours. One, the first day you introduced a spreadsheet and I'm like, well, that looks really cool. I'm going to go try it. And I did that night, came back, and I'm sitting in the room for your second talk and people are gathering at the tables. And I'm starting to talk to people. Now, most of the people around the table are looking at me like I'm crazy, but I'm just like super lit up about playing with this spreadsheet and the results that I got and the potential. And there's this woman at the table and she's just as bubbly as and giddy. And I'm like thinking at first she's making fun of me. It's like being in high school again. She's making fun of me. The reality was, as she kept talking, I realized, no, she's serious. She's just as jazzed about this as I am. So she shared the story that she had been working a couple of months to come up with a forecast, and she tried the spreadsheet to reproduce the results. And it took her about 2.5 hours, glass of wine in the hotel room, and she came with the same dates that she had come up with before. And she's like, I'm not kidding. Me and my team worked for 2.5 months and 2.5 hours produced the same result, and it was just me. So those kind of cool things are going on. I know that some of my fellow board members at Agile Uprising use your stuff. And if you you don't know that, then, you know, hey, you know, there's some more people who are using your stuff. But I really think that it's the kind of thing where you don't want to just use this every once in a while. There are decisions to be made throughout the management of projects. And that's a word that we get funny about in Agile sometimes, but it's still, we've got some money to go do something. Or even if you're doing a continuous value stream type thing, you have choices on where you could spend your time and money, right? So whether you think about it in terms of projects that you go to the guys that have money and beg for money or not, you still are making choices with how to spend your limited resources. It's going on all the time. So it seems like we should teach these techniques to the people that play a role in that ecosystem. And it's a full-time accountability to be able to model and to be able to question the assumptions, right?
Yeah, I agree. This stuff works best when sort of done continuously, and I try and make it light enough so that's possible. It would be like, you know, going hiking and only checking the map at the beginning of the day and then walking random directions. Or a general direction, even, you still don't really know where you are at the end of the day. We wouldn't sort of just check at the beginning and then hope we made our destination. We'd check along the way as well. And that's how forecasting should work. You should keep putting your actuals in and seeing how well your model forecast what you thought was going to happen. Now, the model will be wrong. But how do you know how wrong the model is unless you've got those intermediate course corrections? And you should be delighted when they're wrong because you assumed it was right. And now you've found out that it's not right. And you have the first step of understanding why to make the model better. So this stuff is about continually just proving that you understand the system of delivery in your organization well enough that you should even trust your gut instinct. And, you know, if you use the forecasting tools for nothing else other than to test yourself, where do I think we're going to be in 2 weeks' time or a month's time, and then use that as a benchline to see whether that actually happened. If you can use the tools just in that context to prove that you understand the system you work in well enough, then we've achieved something.
Right, right. You had put out a call for data not terribly many months ago, and I gave you some data that I had from the company I'm at, and you were excitedly sent me back. Oh, look, I got it wrong here. That's what you were excited about, is getting it wrong in your model in some spots. Right. So it's challenging the model, and it's a continuous thing. It's not do it at the beginning of the funding and then don't think about it again.
Yeah. And you know, I'm not promoting what we currently do. And this is the competition here is, forget the original forecast completely and then start again from scratch and do another reforecast. What I'm sort of saying is that, you know, what assumptions did I get wrong with the original model that I can just tweak 3 or 4 cells in a spreadsheet?
Right.
So it's okay to be wrong, and as long as the work to do it again isn't sort of starting from zero, you don't throw the original forecast out. You see from actuals which one of the assumptions you had in there were wrong, because the data that you're actually seeing falls outside of the range that you suspected. And it should.
Right. And you mentioned in your book how you would use this as a management technique. Sit down with your team and say, well, let's discuss why the forecast doesn't seem like it's coming true. Did we get the model wrong? Is there something I don't know?
Yeah. What the model wrong? Which part of the model did we get wrong?
Okay, well, that's right. You did. That's right. Anyway, you look at it, the model missed something.
Exactly. The models will and should never be exact. And the moment that they're exact, they won't be exact the next time you run them, because the system that we're dealing with is constantly evolving and changing and improving and degrading, and often with nothing to do with the project that you're working on. Often it's a rumor of a reorg. It's the time of the year. It's the fact that everyone's on vacation. It's a HR policy that says if you don't use your annual leave, you lose it. Those factors will have a massively larger impact on your forecast than whether it's a 5 or an 8 point story. So where I'm with the no estimates people is I think we estimate the wrong things. I think, you know, we need to realize that the system we're delivering through is constantly changing through no fault of our own, just due to happenstance and things happening, a snowstorm. So, you know, your model's never going to have enough built into it to account for the myriad of stupid things that are going to happen in an organization. Your job is to know that they're occurring and to account for them and make sure that the forecasts you give are the best you can make them.
Right. And this gets back to early in the show, and we are getting it about time. I won't keep you. I really appreciate this conversation. This is great. But this is why you don't want to integrate it and kind of pour concrete around it. It's a spreadsheet so that you think about it just like you think of, Microsoft Excel by itself even, right? It's a tool you pull up and do something with, and then you throw it away. You may not even save the file. It's just to get some calculations done. This makes you think about it the whole way through.
Yeah. Conversation, conversation, conversation.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I love it. Troy, I'm going to put it in the show notes, but your Twitter is T_McGinnis, and your website is focusedobjective.com. Engage you through Twitter, go to the website and check out all the goodies that are over there. I highly encourage you guys to go check that out. Troy, anything else you want to add?
No, thank you. Thank you for your time. Thank you for doing these interviews. I think it's great that we start trying to improve the community and getting everyone slightly better. So great work, you guys.
Yeah, thanks. It's a labor of love. I got lucky enough to join this crowd back in July or August because I was a consumer with a commute of an hour every day, every way. And I ran out of stuff to listen to. And I said, you guys need any help? Could we do more shows? It's such good stuff. And I hope our listeners enjoy it. If you enjoy the episode, please give us a review and subscribe to future episodes on iTunes, Stitcher. Join the discussion at agileuprising.com. We do take sponsorship, little mini sponsorships, you know, for about 25 cents a show. You can be a sponsor. Go to patreon.com/agileuprising for details. And until next week, this is the Agile Uprising signing off.